Where do you see your career in 10 years? What are you doing now to help you get there? The sooner you start enhancing your skills, the sooner you'll be ready. That's why AARP has reskilling courses in a variety of categories like marketing and management to help your income live as long as you do.
That's right. AARP has a bevy of free skill building courses for you to choose from because the steps that you choose to take today will help you to love what you do in the future. And that's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today, we're answering your listener questions.
Buddy, we've got some good ones to get to today that I'm excited to answer. I'm excited to answer all the questions we receive.
I'm just excited to be here.
In particular. You're just excited to be alive?
Yeah, pretty much.
Excited to be healthy? You went for a run this morning?
Trying to avoid the rain, you know?
Which, yeah. Enough about the weather here. I was about to launch into it. Like I mentioned, we've got some great ones. We're going to talk about the best car that you can purchase for under $10,000. A listener is wanting to know what he should be doing about inactive credit cards that are shutting down. And another listener, she is wondering if it's possible to retire on $300,000. She's a little concerned, so hopefully we can alleviate any of her fears.
Oh, and others. Almost sounds like a lean fire question right there.
It kind of, yeah. Oh, dang it. We should have rebranded it as that.
But. Lean fire is essentially when people want to retire and retire early, but not having saved up and invested nearly as much, and they don't mind living on, you know,
a
shoestring budget. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
so
it's possible.
We'll get to our thoughts on that and more in just a sec. But Matt, quick thought. I saw this article in CNET, and it was about the best debit cards for kids. And we've talked about using debit cards for kids in the past. You and I, we've made our kids guinea pigs and tried this out.
Tried it out ourselves.
Yeah, in our own families. Mm-hmm. And I kind of, there's like things I really do like about the debit card approach. But I will say, I think our kids are a little too young for that. And so I've opted to go kind of to the cash envelope system. It just makes it more tangible for the kiddos when they want to whip out some dollars
Dude,
to spend on something.
Totally agree.
I think once they get to their teenage years, hey, I'm ready to transition back to this because we got to get our kids ready for the digital economy. But like green light and go, Henry got a lot of love in that CNET article.
I think they're both great companies.
They're both great.
But yeah, I like what you said. Don't underestimate the power of tangible currency that you can hold. The ability to literally be parted with your dollars when you go to buy something. Something you can smell. Hopefully, they're not tasting it. If they're that young, maybe you shouldn't be. They shouldn't be messing with money.
A lot of germs on money, right? I think so much depends on kind of the age and stage of your kids, though, which tact makes sense. I think starting them early with actual physical coins, hopefully an actual piggy bank, and then moving into dollars and envelopes like I am with 8 and 10-year-old. And then I think maybe in a few years, the 10-year-old will be ready, and then eventually the 8-year-old when they're young teens, for maybe those debit cards, because the training wheels have been on with the cash, and then we move to a more digital form of currency that let's be honest, we need to prepare our kids for that too, because that's what you and I, that's all I ever use. Like I almost never use cash or checks, old school forms.
Yeah, honestly, having cash on hand for the kids with some of their different jobs that they're doing around the house, that has caused us to have more cash on hand, which means we do sometimes use it when we go out. But the other advantage of that is the ability for our kids to not have to go to a device in order to see how much money that they have. Because that's one of the annoying things before, is that it was always within the app as opposed to face-to-face in real life where you're able to count the money up. Smartphones and iPads, they're great. There's a lot of utility that we derive from those devices, but the more I can resist that, I think the better as well. I think it's going to be better from like so many different angles. Actually, this makes me think about, I recently started using my watch. You know, we've got alarms on our watches.
Oh, I don't know. I've never used it.
Whoever thought, it's like this.
And yes, Matt and I have the same watch, by the way.
Yeah, we have the same watch. It's just funny because I think that's something that people used to do all the time with their digital watches. Yeah. You set an alarm on there, use it to wake up. But we're so used to our phones and setting the alarm, using the alarm clock on there. And I'll be honest, it's pretty stinking nice. I have yet to remove the phone from their bedroom, because like research, they say that if you
sleep better if it's gone.
Yeah, I don't feel like I have any problem with that. I feel like I lay down, I conk out, I go to sleep, but
same,
I'm like,
my wife hates me for it.
Yeah, but I'm like, imagine if I did remove the phone. But I think I'm gonna try it out soon. Okay. maybe I'll report back. But the ability to rely on some older technology, older devices, quote-unquote devices, that will help us to accomplish the same task or goal, whatever it is that you're trying to seek, I think those should be considered.
Yeah, so we'll put the link, a link to this article in our show notes for this episode if you're kind of interested, and especially if your kid is a little bit older and they maybe are ready for the debit card form of paying for stuff. But I think to help connect the dots, Matt, like you need those training wheels first. And so, and I do think cash and coins is the best way to do that. It just it creates that tangible relationship to money that you just don't get if you start out with a debit card first. But Matt, let's mention the beer that we're having on this episode. This one is Cuvée de Jonquille. That's really poor French pronunciation.
I think that's pretty good. Jonquille?
Is that?
Maybe. Okay. Normally the L's are
silent?
Quiet.
Okay.
I think.
This beer looks incredibly delicious. The label is amazing. It's perfect springtime beer because it's got blooming daffodils on the label. And this was donated to the show by listener Alice. We'll give our thoughts on this one at the end.
Thank you, Alice.
Yeah, of the episode. But if you have a money question for us, we'd love to take it on an upcoming Ask HTM episode. Just go to howtomoney.com/ask for the simple instructions to submit your voice memo our way, basically. Yeah, you're just recording it on your phone, sending it to us via email at howtomoneypod@gmail.com. Matt, let's get to the first question for this episode. This one is about the timing of an inheritance.
Hi, Matt and Joel. My name is Jocelyn from the San Francisco Bay Area. I learned about you last year and have since been listening to old episodes, currently on the ones from 2022. My fiance and I live in his childhood home and currently pay the mortgage for the house, though we are renting it from his mom. He will be inheriting the house when his mom passes away, but unfortunately, we are not benefiting from any of the homeowner tax credits. Any options on how he can get the house sooner? Can she sell it to him at a lower than market value? I know he would get the property tax benefits if he waited until her passing, but are the benefits of him buying the house from her now worth more? Thanks.
All right, Jocelyn, thank you so much for your question. And quick answer, no. We don't think that it makes a whole lot of sense for you to go ahead and buy that home from your fiance's mother.
But as the dude would say in The Big Lebowski, there's a lot of moving parts here.
There's a lot to discuss here. There's a lot worth considering. And I mean, I guess the reason we want to spend so much time talking about this is because if you do this wrong, it could cost you quite a bit of money, and so we'll do our best to help you to think through this property. But first of all, this actually has a lot to do with your specific state rules, the different regulations and the laws that govern the state of California. And so to everyone else out there who is listening, we do think that you'll learn something from this, but there are also some California-specific rules that we're going to be covering in this answer.
That's right. And specifically, we've got to talk about how the state treats a home that is inherited from a parent and how those rules change over time. And basically, they've become less generous in recent years in the state but they could still save you a bundle on taxes for years to come if you jump through the proper hoops. And I stress jump through the proper hoops because there are many different hoops you need to make sure, many different boxes you need to check off in order to basically do this properly. So in California, there's a 2% annual cap on how much your property taxes can increase. And that means that, Jocelyn, your husband's mom is likely
or
paying.
Or fiance, I think.
Sorry. So you're soon to be
may as well be married.
Right. Like she is paying far less than the market rate if she were to buy that home today. So potentially to the tune of thousands of dollars a year. If you inherit the home, the property taxes do not get reassessed if you jump through the proper hoops. But if you purchase the home from your soon-to-be mother-in-law, they will. So it's really important that you know the rules so that you can play the game properly.
Yeah, that's right. You can read about the home inheritance details by, you can just Google California Prop 19, Proposition 19. And this is something that went into effect fairly recently. But one caveat on that.
And it used to be more generous, by the way. So there are a lot of people who are up in arms about the newer inheritance rules.
But like you said, it's still fair. I don't know. In my opinion, it's still fairly generous. But Joel, like you mentioned, one of the hoops that you are going to have to jump through is the parent that you are inheriting the home from. They can't just own the property. It actually needs to have been their primary residence at the time of their passing. And then, in addition to that, it then needs to become your primary residence. And so if your future mother-in-law, if she is living somewhere else, like living somewhere else as a renter or even an owner, you don't get that favorable tax treatment. And so this is something that you're going to need to discuss as a family. But the savings can be so significant here. It can be so steep that you might want to have her move back into the home, making it her primary because of the massive tax savings. This isn't just some casual conversation here. Like, this is a serious talk where not only you might feel like you're having to sacrifice because you're like, oh, but that's my office that we're going to have to put her back in.
This is going about to cramp my newlywed style.
It's going to cramp her style as well, but, and you'll hear why why this is such a significant talk that we think is worth having.
Yeah. So let's talk about the potential savings and how much home values have increased specifically in the Bay Area. Zillow shows that if you bought a home 23 years ago, that's as far as their data goes back, in the $300,000 range, right? So that would have been kind of expensive back then, but for California, I don't know, maybe somewhere in the normal sphere. Well, it's gone up in value more than 4x. It's now worth more than $1.1 million. But because of those annual property tax increase limits, it's being taxed like it's worth far, far less than it is actually worth on the market today. I heard someone recently who inherited a home, Matt, in California. The taxes jumped from $2,000 annually to $10,000.
Dang.
Yeah. So this is the kind of jump we're talking about. That's kind of hard to stomach. But
it could be even more than that, though.
It could be even more.
It just depends on the circumstances of Jocelyn's soon-to-be mother-in-law.
Yeah, and I think there's like a $1 million limit to what you can accept. So if you bought like a $10 million home and now it's worth $30 million, like you don't get to avoid all those property taxes. It's for kind of middle-income sort of homes. But the only way to avoid this tax increase, again, is to inherit what was your mother-in-law's primary home at the time of her passing, and for you to make it your primary home after the fact, and then to make that filing within a year of that date. Those are the hoops you need to jump through to get the deal.
Totally. Yeah, you mentioned buying the home for a reduced amount, and that certainly is possible. But depending on how much money she's gifted you over the years, that's one consideration. And depending on how much less she's charging you for the home versus what it's worth, she could find herself with a federal tax bill, given that the lifetime gift tax exclusion is more than $12 million. She'll likely be fine, but that will raise your taxes on that home.
Unless she's like an incredibly philanthropic person.
Yes. Yeah. But as far as your taxes, they're likely going to go up to the sale price, but also potentially higher, depending on how big of a discount that we're talking about here. Because if it's like way off, if it's significantly off, it could raise some flags. The assessor, they're going to come out and they're going to determine what the actual fair market value might be. And so it does not seem like, based on the information you've given us, that purchasing the home outright just in order to claim some of the tax deductions that you'll get in the year to year when it comes to filing your taxes. And maybe this is why this is on your mind, because you're thinking through, oh man, there's so much that we're not able to take advantage of that we're giving up as we're preparing our taxes. Imagine if we're able to deduct mortgage interest or property taxes, different things like that. But all of that is going to pale in comparison to the advantage that you would receive by actually inheriting that house versus purchasing it outright.
Yeah, it's like small potatoes, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Compared to oversized gargantuan potatoes, which would be getting that locked in lower tax rate for a long time, right? And then you are subject then to property tax increases at the rate of 2% as well. You've kind of, I mean, it's the goose that keeps laying the golden egg from a property tax perspective. And it's kind of like, Matt, I think somebody with a 3% mortgage, they're not terribly inclined to move right now.
Yep.
The same thing would be true if you own the home, right? With the ridiculously low tax rate that can't go up very much over a long period of time, you're probably going to stay put in that home for maybe the rest of your life, Jocelyn. I don't know. I mean, it is just one of those things that's going to be, it's going to be like golden handcuffs tying you to that home in all likelihood. So what I would do, I'd run the numbers. Like, would you be better off buying the home, getting those additional homestead tax breaks if your mother-in-law bought the home 25 plus years ago? I doubt it. And it sounds like that's the case because you called it your fiance's childhood home.
That's right.
I remember her saying that. And so that means...
She's had this home for a very long time.
If she bought the home 4 years ago, different story. Different story. Yes, the property value has gone up, but not nearly to the tune that it has, given that she's owned it for as long as she has. And so my guess is you're going to be better off with the arrangement you currently have, as long as she's able to make that her primary home again at some point. That stepped up basis and the property tax rule are just crazy generous. They're amazing tax benefits. You're going to benefit from both of those for decades to come as long as you continue to own the home. So California specific rules are kind of interesting. They're nuanced, but if you jump through those hoops, it's one of the most kind of generous tax havens in existence that I've heard about.
That's right. And we are talking about this from a pretty high level. And so, Jocelyn, it might even be worth talking to an estate tax professional because the stakes are so high. Yeah. You want somebody, like we're speaking about it at like a 20,000 foot level, you want somebody that's like inches from the ground who's there in the nitty gritty details with you so that y'all don't end up making us a massive mistake that you could come to regret.
But, and when it comes to property taxes, I actually kind of like the way California does it, the 2% max increase. I think maybe a 5% max annual increase would be more in line with reality. But Matt, there's a lot of cities and states around the country where property taxes can increase 20-30+% in a given year. And it can be shocking to people. It can raise their escrow an insane amount. And especially for lower income residents who live on a fixed income or something like that, it can make it really hard to plan. So I kind of like the max cap on property tax increases. I just think that's good policy.
All right. Well, we got more to get to though.
Yeah.
Canceling credit cards, retirement calculators, all that and more right after the break.
Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Cachava really earns their 52,000-plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the AM in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to Cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's KACHAVA.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. All right, we're back. We got more questions to get to on today's listener questions episode. Matt, this next one comes from a listener, and he's kind of wondering just how bad is it actually to cancel credit cards?
Hey, Matt and Joel, this is Carl. My wife and I are empty nesters living in Roswell, New Mexico. I've been listening for about a year now and really appreciate your insights, your ways of communicating, and in particular, your shame-free approach to talking about money. In the past 10 years, we have moved from first gear to moving regularly now between gears 6 and 7. In the past 4 years, our credit score has moved from a sub-600 to consistently over 750. Our credit cards are paid in full every month. We have 2 home loans for our new residence and our rental, plus a car loan from our credit union, and that's the full extent of our outstanding debt. Here's my question. During the credit building phase of our life, we opened a lot of credit card accounts for about $150,000 worth of credit over 20 cards. Some of them have never even been used once. We regularly use the Wells Fargo Active Cash for the 2% back and have earned over $5,500 in cash back there. And the Chase Amazon Prime, which gives 5 to 6% back in Amazon credit when I shop on Amazon. I just opened one more with the only airline that flies out of Roswell, because for my $99 annual fee, I get a free checked bag on every flight for myself and companions. Again, all of our cards are paid off in full every month. A couple of those cards have been closed recently due to inactivity, and others have sent notices threatening to do the same. How hard should I work to keep those accounts open? I don't need the access to cash, but I don't want to hurt my credit that I have worked so hard to build. Thank you for what you do. I've told so many friends about your program. I think you're a blessing to all of us.
Matt, I'd prefer to talk about UFOs and aliens, considering where Carl is submitting his question from.
Roswell?
Yeah. I want to know more about what it's like to live there.
The truth is out there, Joel. That's where there was like a UFO crash back in like the 40s or 50s or something like that. Or supposed UFO.
Yeah, I was going to say, now, what's your stance on that?
What, whether or not there's actually UFO?
You just made it sound like you 100%, that's what happened. So I'm curious.
No,
what you're
like supposed, I don't know.
Okay.
Like, would you believe in UFOs?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't think I've made a definitive conclusion on that.
What came out last year? I feel like there's a whole lot of hubbub about the Pentagon or the FBI like unclassifying documents, where it's like, no. Yeah, there's legit been stuff, and we have no idea how it was constructed.
Yeah.
And I don't know.
This is very much turning into the Joe Rogan podcast. So let's move on.
All right, Carl, we appreciate you telling others about the show. You're talking about how you're letting everybody you know about the program. That is awesome. We appreciate you.
It matters a lot. Thank you.
Yeah, and actually earlier on in his question, he mentioned something about shame. Thank you for bringing that up as well, because we think that a shame-free approach is really important to us. There are other folks out there, and they take a different tactic where they're out there trying to make people feel bad about the money mistakes that they've made in their past. But the truth is, those are often made out of ignorance. There's a lack of financial education, and they don't. They're mistakes, I feel like, that are oftentimes made out of innocence, as opposed to, like, I mean, who's out there like deliberately like, oh, I'm going to totally screw myself for the next 30
years. It's like sins of omission versus commission. It's typically because they don't know better, especially in their youth.
Exactly. And honestly, in our experience, shame cycles tend to perpetuate bad behavior, because if you're ashamed of something, what is the typical human response to that? You hide. Yeah. You paper over it. You don't talk about it.
You clam up.
Which then means it's less likely that you're going to have learned from those mistakes. We want folks out there to be moving forward and talking about it, getting it out in the open. I think that's the path, a healthier path to doing that. Because even if you learn from your mistakes, if you haven't processed it very well, you probably are going to have some unhealthy habits.
Yeah.
Some, you know, just some warped views around money in particular.
Yeah, and maybe you might be able to alter your behavior, but your psychology isn't humming along the way you want it to.
Exactly.
Because you're still feeling the reverby sort of shame instincts, right? Which are just so unhealthy for us.
And then you hit some financial stress and all that comes out sideways.
Yeah.
Affecting those around you.
Exactly.
Look at us. We sound so well balanced and healthy here.
I'm using all
it's
the
a full
stuff,
180 from the UFO talk just right. two minutes ago.
This is all the stuff my wife's learning in grad school. I just glean from her and then I try to like infuse it in here occasionally, even though I don't really know what I'm talking about. She's the professional. Okay, but Carl, it sounds like you're handling your credit cards well, which is great. Something that we talk about regularly. We love credit cards, but only if you use them properly. And having a few credit cards at your disposal, if you use them in the right way, is a great thing, right? And so you've got the main bases covered here. You've got the 2% cashback card for general spending. You got the Amazon card since you shop there regularly. I didn't realize this, Matt. He mentioned 5 or 6% cashback. Recently, when I was buying something on Amazon, you know what they do now? I thought it was just straight up 5%, but they'll give you 6% if you opt to delay the delivery of an order that you're making. So it's kind of like they used to do digital credits.
Oh, yeah. They don't do that anymore?
They might. I don't know. But if you have the Amazon credit card, they'll at least offer you this instead. So that's kind of cool. It's got the no annual fee, 5% cash back on every purchase. I think
Kate's the one who's typically in charge of our Amazon purchases.
Yeah.
That's actually, we've never dived into the nitty-gritty of this, but so I handle literally all of our finances, all of our credit cards, all the different bonuses and welcome offers and everything else that we are on track for. But the Amazon card, that is the only one that she 100% handles. Like, and it's mostly because of returns.
Yeah.
Because she'll make a purchase on there and it'll bridge 2 months, and I'm like, oh, what the heck is this? So she actually completely handles it, accounts for it. That being said, I didn't know about the five. I'll have to ask her about that.
Yeah. Plus, Carl, by the way, he's got the airline specific card for his flights. Depending on where and how much you fly, an airline specific card, it might be the best thing.
Mm-hmm.
But other folks out there might do better with the Chase Sapphire Preferred or the Capital One Venture card. We've got an article about our favorite travel cards up on the site. We'll link to in the show notes. But yeah, which card you choose, so much of the determination of that depends on your habits, like how you're going to use those cards, and then where you actually spend most of your dollars.
That's right. Yeah, and I like how much Carl has been able to raise his credit score. Good work there. And so when you get a notice from a credit card company about potentially shutting down a card because you're not using it, honestly, the best thing to do is just use it. It basically hits the reset switch on whatever amount of time that they're looking to see some activity on that card. And our favorite suggestion, and this is by far the easiest too, is for you just to put like one or two small recurring monthly bills on that credit card so that it can stay active, and then just have that thing auto-pay. So it's literally not on your mind at all. And anytime I'm just going to make a card up, Capital One Quicksilver. And you're like, well, the Quicksilver, that should be synonymous with, let's say, Netflix. So anytime you see that Quicksilver payment go out from your checking account,
you can even give it a cute nickname like QuickFlix.
You can put a nickname on it, or you just can account. I don't know how it is that you track your spending, but that's just an easy way to keep that thing active.
Yeah, because you don't necessarily want your wallet laden down with 14 credit cards. But
no,
if you've
exactly.
just got the auto payment thing on that, you can leave the credit card in the drawer, basically, and kind of set it and forget it if you've got automatic payments going as well. So
yeah.
it's the automated way to keep that thing going and not lose it.
Exactly, yeah. And so that being said, so on one hand, we definitely do want you to keep your credit score high. But at the same time, I love that you have a high credit score, but it's not the end all be all. What that is, it's more of an indicator of the incredible progress that you've been able to make with your finances over, I think he said, over the past 4 years. Like he said that they started out literally, I think, in money gear number one,
mm-hmm.
and now they're bouncing back and forth between money gear 6 and 7. Carl,
so much progress.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Like you have crushed it. And so as fun as it was for you to see your credit score increase significantly over the recent years, that shouldn't necessarily be your ultimate goal. I guess it kind of depends on what your goals are, but I think there can be a tendency to obsess over that because it's a grade, essentially, and you start playing a game and you start winning the game and you want to continue to win that game, and pretty soon you're obsessed with the game as opposed to some of the bigger, more important things in life.
Yeah.
Don't let the tail wag the dog. Don't get distracted by your credit score if it's not something that you're looking to utilize.
Especially, let's say you're at 810 and 760 is really like gold, right? Anything above 760, you're going to get the best terms no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you cancel a couple cards and you go from 810 to 790. Well, guess what? You're still in primo territory. It doesn't really matter. And so I think, Matt, what you're trying to say is like, pay attention to it, but don't pay too much attention to it because it's not worth your attention.
Exactly.
Like, it's worth some attention, and you've already paid a lot of attention to it. You've really made a lot of progress, but you can overdo it, spend too much time thinking about something that once you've gotten it to a certain point, it doesn't matter all that
doesn't
much.
Doesn't really matter. Exactly.
Yeah. And so I do think there's some people that obsess over perfection in the credit score sphere. And guess what? You don't get any extra medals or...
No extra credit.
No ribbons if you achieve an 850. Nobody cares except for you. Maybe your spouse, but probably not even them.
Like, honestly, like, literally, I would rather you take a hit and maybe even allow those things to close if it allows you to focus on the other things in your life that might be more important to you.
Okay, so let's talk about what happens when a card gets canceled, right? So much of what happens to your credit score if your credit card goes by the wayside, if they cancel it or if you cancel it, either way, so much depends on the age of your other accounts and the overall credit usage versus your credit limit, right? And so it's worth asking the question, do you need to use your credit score in a significant way soon? Are you buying a home? Are you taking out a loan on a car? Are you trying to rent an apartment? Those are all things that are going to influence how high your credit score needs to be. And again, if you're above 760, everyone's happy with you.
Yeah.
The lenders, the landlords, whoever it might be, right? But if a couple of those accounts, let's say you're at like 760 right now though, and a couple of those accounts close next month and your score dropped by 20 points, would that hamstring your ability to lease an apartment or get the best interest rate on a home loan? I mean, probably not the apartment thing, but maybe the home loan. It might drop you. You might be paying an extra quarter of a point or something like that, which would be frustrating and would cost you significant money over the life of the loan. So, I mean, the more likely you are to need to use your credit score to get an additional line of credit, the more important it is to play the game and keep those cards active in your credit mix. Take that balanced approach, right? Where, yeah, you do pay attention to your credit score, but you're not overly affected and impacted by every little gyration.
Totally. You might not even notice much of a score drop at all if those other card metrics are pretty solid. But given how easy it is, we would suggest just keep them around, given assuming that there aren't annual fees associated with those cards where you're not necessarily taking advantage of that. But it sounds like he's on a good path.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like he wasn't there for a while, but now he is.
You mentioned annual fees, and I think it's worth mentioning that real quickly. If you use a card that has a significant annual fee and you're not getting the value for that annual fee, Matt and I, we don't mind annual fees because lots of times the annual fee cards come with tons of perks that actually make it well worth it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not getting the value for that card with an annual fee, that is when, and you don't necessarily need to use your credit soon, Matt, to your point, I think that's when it's okay to close that one card, but you might want to piggyback, open a different card instead, just to make sure that you're not seeing a significant hit over time. So much depends on when you need to use your credit, but I think that's the one case. Or you can, instead of closing that card, oftentimes you can call the credit card issuer and say, hey, can you move me actually down to a different credit card that doesn't have an annual fee? That way it doesn't work as a cancellation. You're just kind of using a different credit card that they offer. And often credit card issuers are more than happy to do that for you.
Yeah, because they want to keep you around as a customer. But Carl, yeah, we hope that gets you pointed in the right direction. Joel is here from our next listener, and she's got some worries about her financial situation.
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Michelle from Rehoboth, Massachusetts. Your show is informative and easily digestible. You have reinforced my thoughts on investing and also spending habits. I sincerely hope you never run out of money topics. Recently, you had Gwen Merz on your show and discussed why she left the FIRE movement. During that interview, Gwen said she had $200,000 to $300,000 saved and was all set for retirement. Retirement is my biggest concern. In 1995, my grandfather retired with just over $100,000 in his 401k. After retirement, he moved his 401k into an annuity. He has withdrawn over $300,000 in the last 29 years from that annuity and still has over $100,000 remaining. This account has done very well for him. If my husband and I stay with our current employer, we will both receive a pension. Our retirement accounts are currently at $160,000, approximately $13,500 contributed each year. Our employer matches our retirement contributions up to 6%. I've done retirement calculators and they've never seemed to be in our favor. My husband and I live outside of Boston. The cost of living is high. However, we will probably stay here until we retire in the next 15 to 20 years. We have three debts, my motorcycle at 1% interest with 2.5 years remaining, our mobile home at 7.5% with 1.5 years remaining, and his car with 5 years left. The mobile home is our weekend getaway. We have yet to buy a house. Our credit cards are paid in full every month, and I've opened up a Roth IRA and we'll start contributing to that soon. If we were to keep with the same contributions and work until we're both 65, we would have $440,000 in our retirement accounts, not including any earnings from these investments. Is $200,000 to $300,000 in retirement accounts enough to live off of realistically? Thank you so much, Michelle.
Oh, Matt, there's so much in this. I will say a couple of things. One, Michelle's cool. She rides a motorcycle. I wish I was as cool as Michelle.
Well, was not excited to hear about the motorcycle. But that's a really low rate. That's crazy low.
I was trying to get a hand-me-down motorcycle from Emily's grandpa, who's like too old to ride it these days.
Ooh.
But apparently he'd gifted it to another cousin already.
Oh,
so
no!
It's kind of bummed. It's like this really, really old crotchety Honda, but it was awesome.
Was it like a 70 CV?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Like what?
So like that's the kind of 450, I think. It was great.
I'm like, that's, yeah. So I had a 550. I had a 76 Honda 550.
They're so cool. The
thing was awesome.
So cool.
Very cool.
Michelle asked about, like, or mentioned, yeah, how are we going to keep doing the show? I think we're going to do a show for a long time. It's super fun. And unless you find a new best friend and you try to bring them on instead of me, and then I'll be upset.
If I do find a new best friend, I won't tell you.
Okay.
Like, well, you're my best friend.
Just keep it secret. Yes.
Spread off into the sunset on motorcycles together, buddy.
A best friend in reserve.
With our matching watches.
That's right. All right. Let's get to the heart of Michelle's question here. Like, she mentioned Gwen when we had Gwen on the show, and Gwen was a fire adherent, and now she's not so much. And she had saved in her like extreme fire devotion days something like more than $200,000 in her retirement accounts, probably closer to $300,000, right? And was that all she needed to stash away? I think so. It's interesting, Matt. She told us during that conversation that she was continuing to contribute to her retirement accounts, just dialing the percentage back, which I think is smart, because why not continue to save and invest? You don't have to like throw the baby out with the bathwater. Even though you're not fire anymore, it doesn't mean you stop saving completely, right? The reason why she thought she had saved and invested enough is because she has so many decades before she's going to want or need to tap those funds.
That's
right?
True.
I don't remember exactly how old Gwen was, Matt. I mean, she's certainly younger than us, but maybe she's like 30, something like that, early 30s.
I would guess early 30s.
And so let's say she's got 25 years left until she needs to tap those funds, which is still like on the short side, given what she could, how long she could leave that money invested. Even with just that static $200,000 number that she's been able to amass, she's likely going to grow that nest egg to about $1.4 million in 25 years with an 8% return. That's not factoring in other contributions either. That is the power of compounding returns. So that's why when you hear the $200,000 number, it certainly doesn't sound like, oh, that's not enough. That's not going to be enough for her to live on. But because of the return she's likely to see in the market, she's going to have a whole heck of a lot more than that to draw from.
Yeah. So Michelle, that's a huge part of the equation here. Like you said, you weren't factoring in returns. Like you were just looking at contributions, how much you and your husband would be able to set aside. But those compounding returns, that has a dramatic impact on what your nest egg is going to look like far
off.
That's
a goal that we all have, right, Matt? Is for our money to work harder for us than we do for it. And eventually that becomes reality. The longer we've been at it, the more we've been able to set aside.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Michelle, she might hear this and think, well, guys, I don't have 25 plus years. Like Gwen is like a young whippersnapper when she felt like she hit that. I'm a little further along in my career. I think Michelle has maybe fewer years, but even still, you got to factor in those returns because like hopefully you are actually investing inside of your retirement accounts. You're not just funneling it into a money market or where it's sitting there in cash. If so, this means that you're going to have far more than the amount that you've calculated that you're going to have set aside, especially since you're continuing to contribute to those accounts. You're not talking about hitting pause. And so run the numbers with that in mind. That's just a big part of the equation. But it is also crucial to think about the other factors that are going to influence your living costs in retirement. And specifically, I'm talking about your other sources of income, like the pension, like Social Security. You can log in to over at ssa.gov to the Social Security website, and you can see projections of what your monthly payment amount is going to be. And if you're able to hold off claiming Social Security until you're a little bit older, maybe until you're 70, that's going to massively increase that monthly check. It's often best for the highest earning spouse to hold off claiming until then.
If they're healthy, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of individual factors here, but what we're pointing you to is the fact that it's not just going to be you relying on the amount that you've set aside.
Mm-hmm.
You've got multiple streams of income here as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's like $30,000 to $40,000 a year, depending on your income. Take a look, log into your Social Security account. I logged in just the other day just to kind of check, and I was like, "Whoa, okay, cool. If that holds up, nice. that's not a bad addition to my retirement repertoire, right?" And so, I just think that's a game changer for people's future. And I think there's also like some skepticism, maybe, and maybe that's where that's coming from, a lot of our listeners, especially younger listeners, have skepticism that Social Security will be there. And we've talked about the need for massive Social Security reforms and the fact that, like, it can't continue at this pace. But I do think Social Security is going to be there for people in the future, because no politician wants to be the politician that axed a popular program. On top of that, I'd say if you're not considering how your investments will increase in value along with other sources of income, Michelle, you're going to be stressed about your ability to retire, right? You're going to be tied up in knots, I think. But so much of that stems just from not looking at the whole picture, right? And don't forget, too, that your living costs are hopefully going to decline in some way, too. You mentioned those debts and the payoff cycle and how some of them are going to be paid off soon, in like a year, and others are going to be paid off in 5 or 6 years. But it would be ideal to have paid off vehicles. Like your mobile home, your vacation home is going to be paid off shortly as well. I think the key here is to do some more calculations, factoring all those things in, and you'll find that you're in much better shape than you think you are. I think you're headed in the right direction for sure.
Yeah, I mean, bottom line, what we're talking about here is increasing the amount of money that you are able to set aside. And so, like you mentioned, opening that Roth, contributing there, I think that's a good idea as well, because it's an incredibly flexible retirement account. But it allows you to start banking even more for your future, because you've got, I think maybe you've got like 15 to 20 years, right? Even $3,000 a year into a Roth over 20 years, that's going to add up to an additional $150,000 for your retirement years. And so we want you to continue to increase your savings rate. And I don't know, maybe Joel, you seem to be the optimistic one here. Because Michelle, she has some payments, right? She's got the motorcycle, she's got her husband's car, they've got the mobile home. And it's easy to envision a future where those things, pretty soon, those things are going to be paid off. Mm-hmm. And those are payments that she's going to no longer have. But she mentioned Gwen. And I can't remember if we talked about this on the show when we interviewed Gwen. And so here's some little behind the scenes. When you interview someone for a podcast, you end up chatting some before, you have the interview, and then you end up chatting some after the fact. And I oftentimes wish that we would record those conversations too.
We can.
One of the things that we talked about that I don't think we talked about within the actual episode is the fact that she's getting married. Like, she has found herself as a new stepmom. Because the guy that she's marrying has a daughter. They just bought a new house. I don't think we talked about any of this within the actual interview. It was just kind of personal catching up. And so what I'm pointing to is the fact that, yes, there might be certain expenses that might be fading out of your life, but it is always difficult to forecast some of the unforeseen expenses, and not sort of emergencies, but just things that we willingly sign up for, things that we're excited to sign up for. Like, I'm shocked at how much it costs for me to support my family right now. Mm-hmm. Like, compared to what it used to, like 10 years ago, even
gymnastics, ballet, and piano,
back when it was just Kate and food and clothing.
Soccer, yeah,
granted, not everybody out there has four kids. Can be expensive. It's just it's surprising that it costs so much. And so I guess it's worth thinking through, well, okay, there's a chance that your expenses may not go down. And so all of that is a reason why we're trying to encourage you perhaps to save a little bit more. Yeah. We don't want you to discount the additional streams of income that you have, because I think you might be in a better position than you think. You don't need to discount the actual earnings and those compounding returns, because that's going to have a significant impact. But don't underestimate potential future costs and what future Michelle might want to do with her time, especially in retirement.
And therefore the power of contributing a little bit more, putting some into that Roth. You don't even have to max it out, although you can. We wouldn't be mad if you did. But it's one of those things, maybe that's the goal for over the next few years, as you start to lose some of those payments, they roll off, you're done with those debts. Start to fund that Roth even more significantly than you are today, right? Yeah. So, and by the way, it might make sense, and we don't say this often, but to see a financial planner, to talk to somebody for a little bit, that could be a massive help. And I think maybe a psychological help and potentially talking about some of these specific choices as well, helping you maybe confirm that you're on the right path and maybe the tweaks that you need to make to ensure that you have enough money in 15 to 20 years time. Hello Nectarine is a cool site, and you can hire someone for just $150 an hour. Matt, my parents actually did that because they are newly retired.
Oh, cool.
And they just kind of wanted some confirmation on some things. And we talked through a bunch, and I was like, great.
Sure, son, let me get a second opinion.
They're like, we don't trust you very much at all. And so we're going to hire somebody with a suit and tie, because the clothes I choose are not nearly that refined.
You just got to put on something nicer when you go there to talk to them.
You're right.
You can't wear your ratty t-shirt.
I know. I think that's what it is, though. Well, you know, and
you got to sell yourself, Joel.
The prophet is not valued or understood in their hometown, Matt. That's part of it too. But no, I think it was smart for them to talk to somebody like that too, who has advanced education. $150 an hour. It's not too bad, and they learned a lot. I think it was a really good combo for them and gave them added confidence. So maybe that's a good place for Michelle to go. And last but not least, you mentioned your grandpa's annuities. I would say some annuities are okay. Most are not. And so like having your money in the market over decades is typically, at least historically, going to lead to the best returns. And there are so many different flavors of annuities. It's like a soda machine now, Matt, one of those Coke freestyles. There's like a billion different flavors of every kind of soft drink you could imagine.
I hate those things.
They don't taste as good as the actual mixed syrup.
I don't like the interface. Like it's like a, it reminds me of like keyword clouds back in the blogging days. Uh-huh. Like, cause it's got the screen, and I'm like, wait, it's not organized at all. It's just kind of like this web of high fructose corn syrup. Just like, yeah. I like the old school, you know, four ice dispenser, another four on the other side. Old school.
It's another example of too much choice in our modern era.
Too much choice, right? And too much technology, going back to the whole screens and sticking with the tangible, concrete things in real life, baby.
Right. And so when it comes to annuities and the overwhelming choices in annuities that you can have, it's kind of like one of those Coke freestyle machines. And it's similarly bad for your health if you opt for most of those annuity choices. A lot of them come with incredibly high expenses. Yeah. And so there may be a couple of exceptions, immediate payout and longevity annuities, because they take the nest egg you've built up and help you construct a steady stream of income for retirement with significantly reduced fees. But because of Social Security, if you've been a great saver over the years, that might not be necessary either. So, annuities, maybe your grandpa did well with them, but for most people, that's not a great choice.
Yeah. So, okay, like one of the problems here is that it almost seemed like she was starting to look to annuities as sort of like a
lifeline.
Yeah, to kind of like pin her hopes onto that. And she's like, he's done very well with that. And I was curious because I'm like, okay, he's done very well, but compared to what? And so she said for the past 29 years is when he moved his 401k, which was just over $100,000 into that annuity. And so I went back and looked at the S&P. What did the S&P do over the past 29 years? Had someone taken $100,000, and so she said over $100,000, I ran the numbers on just $100,000 even, and you also would have been able to take out over $300,000 over the past 29 years and still have, like, specifically $316,000 is what you would have been able to draw down on, and still have over $100,000 in that account. And that's just from the S&P 500.
Yeah.
And so what I guess what I'm pointing out here is that in her mind,
it sounds amazing.
It's this magical thing. And it sort of feels like, oh, that's, we just got to get ourselves one of those. Like, that seems to be the ticket. That's the golden ticket. When in reality, that's just average. Yeah. Like, that's just, that is something that is available to anybody and everybody. And that's the S&P 500. And so, Michelle, I think what you said, Joel, is good. The ability for her to talk to somebody and to maybe crunch the numbers for her to provide some reassurance, because I think she's going to be in a better financial position than she thinks, but she's just worried. There's a lot of uncertainty that lies ahead. And until someone and certain folks wrap their heads completely around the problem, they're always going to feel a little bit like, what if?
Yeah.
And I totally agree with you that for someone to work through it with her, to crunch the numbers, I think that could go a really long way.
And that's where Meet Nectarine is great, because they don't, when you meet with a financial advisor through that site, they're not trying to sell you anything. And most, there are a lot of financial advisors out there who, if you don't vet them properly, you might end up doing business with someone who, yeah, maybe it seems cheap on the surface, but they're going to try to sell you something that's going to cost you a heck of a lot more over the years, like an annuity that maybe might not be the best thing for you. Totally. So at Nect, it's really just an advice conversation. You know, say, hey, this is kind of what I'm working with. And they say, here's what I think you should do. It's less about like, let me sell you this random product. Because I appreciate that, because then the incentives are properly aligned.
Totally.
And,
we don't have a relationship with Hello Nectarine.
No.
But like, you can also find a CFP, Certified Financial Planner. Someone with those initials, that acronym, means they have to be a fiduciary. But not all fiduciaries are CFPs. There might be folks out there who have a wealth of knowledge that do a great job with as financial coaches who are also fiduciaries. And so that's one of the keywords that you want to make sure to know whether or not they are fiduciary.
XY Planning Network is another great place to turn. But totally. Again, you might be charged more for a more comprehensive plan. That might be worth it. Just trying to give you the cheapest option. But all right, Matt, we've got more to get to on this episode, including what's the most inexpensive starter car for a youngster? We'll get to that right after this. Cachava is the all-in-one superfood shake made up of high-quality plant-based nutrients. It's got greens, superfruits, plant proteins, antioxidants, adaptogens, probiotics, and in other words, everything your body craves to feel your best. This is where Cachava really earns their 52,000 plus five-star reviews. It tastes amazing. It's creamy and smooth with just water, and it comes in five delicious flavors. You can choose from chocolate, vanilla, chai, matcha, and coconut acai. Cachava is offering How to Money listeners 10% off for a limited time. I've been using Cachava in breakfast smoothies in the morning recently. It's just so nice to pack in a bunch of nutrients early in the a.m. in a way that's satisfying and energizing. So if you want to optimize your breakfast, your workout shake, be sure to check out Cachava. Just go to Cachava.com/howtomoney. That's spelled K-A-C-H-A-V-A, and get 10% off your first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com/howtomoney.
When it comes to financial advice, you got to trust the source. That's why you listen to this podcast. And if you're looking to upgrade your wallet, you need to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. If you're paying for vacations with whatever card is in your wallet, you could be missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table.
You can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade, lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter.
I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
All right, man, we are back from the break. Let's land this plane. We've got our Facebook question of the week. This one was from Beth. And like you alluded to before the break, Joel, she said, "We are currently looking for an inexpensive starter car for our daughter. I'm finding it difficult to find anything I would consider reasonable. Where's the best place to find used cars these days?" And the first thing I want to highlight here is two things: inexpensive and reasonable. Because some folks are going to have different definitions of they consider reasonable for their kids. Because there might be some folks that are thinking, "Well, this is my only child. This is my pride and joy. I got to do whatever it takes to ensure that they are in the most sophisticated, up-to-date, safe Volvo that exists."
That's right.
Or whatever.
Everybody's going to have a different
Volvos always
on that.
Do well on the National Highway crash test, don't they?
That's at least our calling card was safety for so many years, even though it came at a cost. Like, that was the place you turned if that's what you really, really wanted, was the most safe vehicle.
Yeah.
But the answer to this question keeps getting harder and harder. That's because the pandemic broke the car market, and we're still not back to normal, even though things have calmed down at least a little bit.
I feel like we've gotten much closer to pre-pan normalcy.
I think the Tesla price cuts have contributed to that, at least in the EV sphere. We are seeing more supply on dealer lots, and that has kind of created a relief valve for the used car market, so ensuring that prices aren't escalating like they were before, which is a rarity. Like, typically, your used car doesn't go up in value. For a little bit there, it did, but I think we're back to kind of normal times where cars are depreciating assets. And I always, personally, Matt, I like buying from a legitimate individual owner. That is, I think, often how you score the best price. And for me, it's just the place I feel most comfortable buying a car. And I think part of that is because it can allow you to have more information on how it was maintained. Lots of times when you're buying from a third party, you don't have some of those same records. And there are so many dealers and brokers out there now that it can be hard to find, I would say, a legitimate person selling their own vehicle peer-to-peer. Auto Trader lets you filter by real private sellers. That's how I found my last car, the 2012 Odyssey minivan. So I would suggest turning there and putting that filter on. But like Matt, if there's like 60 results, typically 3 or 4 are private sale results. Like the vast majority are dealerships or brokers trying to sell an automobile. So
it's, by the way, did you say 2012? I thought you'll have a 2013 on Odyssey.
I don't know. It's one of the two.
The only reason I say that is because I use that one additional year older vehicle to justify us getting the next car for our family.
Oh, really?
Just be like, well, ours is older than yours.
Yeah.
In my mind, y'all's is a 2013. I don't know.
That's a good question.
It does not matter.
I'll look it up. I think it's a 2012. But I think, okay, so Auto Trader, I mentioned that. Facebook Marketplace, that's a good place to turn as well. But again, lots of brokers have flooded that marketplace too, so you can reach out. You might think, oh, this is somebody close by, and this is their own car that they've had for a long time or whatever, but then turns out it's a broker selling it. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a great car, but I just feel less comfortable buying a car from a broker, not knowing exactly kind of what that car has been through. So I would say do your best, take your time. If you're in a rush, you're going to be more likely to make a mistake. So the longer time frame you have to purchase a car, the more you can look for a deal and the more you can look for the right car for you that's going to provide that peace of mind and hopefully be a car that'll serve you well for a lot of years.
Totally. Yeah, I completely agree there. Not being forced into a decision, I feel like it always puts you in a stronger position when it comes to purchasing anything.
Yeah.
But definitely when it comes to purchasing a vehicle.
It's one thing if you got to buy a pair of shoes, but if you got to buy a used vehicle with unknown problems or an unknown history, that's a different thing. Like that's a whole ball of wax.
Even with a new pair of shoes, it's kind of like, well, do I need a new pair of shoes right now? No, I can wait. It's like, okay, well, then that allows you to wait for the sales, see what comes along.
Totally. One just has higher financial stakes, I guess.
Exactly. But then beyond finding those private sellers, Beth, we would recommend for you to do your due diligence. Get out there, test drive a few cars, and know what questions to ask as you're looking as well, because you're going to know why it is that they're selling the car. You want to know what sort of maintenance schedule that they've maintained, maintenance that they've performed. I think those two questions are going to reveal a lot. And then you can look up the value on KBB. You can look it up on Edmunds as well, where you can, of course, ensure that you are getting a good deal, that it's a fair price. And Joel was kind of highlighting how it's great to be able to buy from an individual seller. But we talk about CarMax. We talk about Carvana a lot as well. We purchased our 2012 Honda Odyssey. I'm pretty sure yours was a 2013.
It might be. I am better than you.
We got. But when you are looking to some of these different companies, they've got fantastic return policies. If you haven't been listening for a while, I was able to get Carvana to pay for a new timing belt. That was awesome. Basically, I mean, it's like, how much does that cost? I don't even know.
It's usually like $1,100, I think.
It's significant, but that's something I was able to...
You basically say, hey, listen, I'm going to return it because my mechanic says this, and they say, well, we don't actually want you to return it, so we'll just pay for it.
Exactly, and this is, I don't know, maybe today they would say, oh, yeah, okay, go ahead, bring it back. But at that point in time, they took care of that for me. But keep in mind, when you are looking online in particular, and you're looking at some of the different dealers, some of the different brokers, certainly CarMax and Carvana, they're often going to specialize in gently used models. They're going to be a little bit newer. You're probably not going to find an inexpensive car there.
Depending on what you mean by inexpensive, I guess.
I guess it's always
according to our standards.
Subjective. But always make sure that regardless of where it is that you're purchasing the car from, always make sure that you get any car that you're looking at, that you are getting it checked out by a mechanic that you trust, because this can obviously save you a lot of money. It can save you a lot of potential headache in the future. And cars are always going to need repairs. But for most of those who don't know much about fixing cars, I think getting a professional set of eyes on that ride before you fork over the money is going to be crucial. And sometimes it just gives you the ability to negotiate the price down further.
It's like an inspection on a home almost.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, keep that in mind as well. It's not just where it is that you are purchasing that vehicle, but how you negotiate and how you go about performing that due diligence.
And our van needed like $2,800 repairs. So $1,600 total within 6 months after buying it. And we were like, oh man, this stinks. We haven't had any to do anything to it since though. And so you just kind of never know when some of those repairs are going to come along. They weren't things that a mechanic would have found. Like it was an alternator. You kind of don't know when that's going to fail. It just kind of happens, right? And so it's important to do your due diligence, but also have money set aside for repairs because it's an older vehicle, right? It's still going to save you the most money over time. And by the way, the number one vehicle, so she specifically asked, what's the best place to find used cars. Well, I just kind of want to mention maybe a couple of different makes and models that would be, I think, worthy choices too, Matt. The number one vehicle that most folks in our Facebook group mentioned was the Honda Fit. And I think that's a good call.
Ooh.
The 2011 Honda Fit is what Consumer Reports actually recommends. I guess that's a standout model, standout year. Mazda 3, Toyota Corolla, those are two others that were solid buys in that category. So one other suggestion, by the way, prioritize low mileage over the age of the vehicle. That's something I would say. Like, I would be willing to go a couple model years older if it meant 20 to 30,000 fewer miles. I just think typically that's going to be the sweet spot. Older vehicles with lower mileage is going to be kind of the best bang for your buck so much of the time. And make sure also to call your insurance company to see what insuring the vehicle is going to cost, because that can influence what you end up going with. You might be able to save a significant amount on that front if you opt for liability coverage only and you self-insure a little bit more, have more set aside in savings.
Yeah, Beth, I am not looking forward to having to join the ranks of folks who are insuring vehicles that are being driven by teenage drivers. So it sounds like she's got a daughter who's like right there. She's ready to purchase that vehicle. One of the things that I would say, and something that I'm doing currently with my oldest daughter, who's 10 years old, is starting the conversation now to put it on the radar that, hey, you want something to drive when you're 16 years old that you can quote unquote call your own. You should start saving now, because our oldest daughter, she actually has a decent... It's funny, we're talking about...
Mine's been saving since the womb, Matt. Why starting so late?
You're talking about physical cash versus digital currency. This past weekend, the kids, they all pulled out their piggy banks, which were these old like Smuckers, like some jelly jars or whatever that we made for them like years ago. And they all made their own jar, or they like redecorated them and stuff like that. But it's the first time our oldest daughter had counted up her money. She's got a chunk of change sitting in there. And the conversations that we're starting to have with her is just like, hey, if you want a vehicle that you call your own, you need to start saving now. This is money that can go towards that. We'll match whatever it is that you put towards a vehicle. And so for all the parents out there, what's great here is to realize that this isn't an expense that you have to take on, that you have to tackle on your own. Like, your kids, as they get older, they're slowly but surely turning into adults. And with that natural maturity, I guess, that they acquire, they also have...
And that high school job?
Some of that financial responsibility, yes, is going to be laid at their feet. And so I think that's a great way. Obviously, it's great because they've got skin in the game, right? Hopefully that means they're going to take care of the vehicle as opposed to just like totally trash it and leave... fast foods, I don't know, whatever. I'm just picturing all sorts of terrible stuff that my kids might do. And so there's some skin in the game and there's some ownership and they're like, oh, this is my car. But obviously you've got the financial benefit of that as well. You're going to have to spend hopefully half as much because this is something that they have been working towards. And I'm just only imagining the amount of money my daughter might be able to have set aside 6 years from now. Like, that's a long time to have to build up a pretty decent sort of quote-unquote nest egg to go towards a vehicle.
I still remember my first vehicle was an 89 Toyota Corolla, or was it, no, Camry. And
Joel and his car details, you know how he is.
$1,800 is what it cost, $1,800. And I spent, it was all my money. And the pride I took in owning that thing and how well I took care of it.
I love it.
Yeah, it mattered. And so I do think, parents who think, oh, I've got to buy this car for them, I don't think that's necessarily the best way to think about it. And maybe they don't have to come up with the whole funding. It would have been probably nicer to start out with a slightly nicer car than what I had, but I love that car.
Yep.
And I still think I'd be driving it to this day if I hadn't gotten in a wreck. So, so just think about that too. How can you incorporate your daughter's ability to earn money and help pay for this thing instead of just putting it all on your shoulders?
Totally. And I think the earlier you have this conversation, because it's tougher when they're 16, it's just like, well, how the heck am I supposed to come up with $8,000 right now?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, well, yeah, good point.
Yeah.
But for the parents out there who have kids who are a little bit younger, getting ahead of that wave and being able to kind of ride that thing in as opposed to it just like financially crashing down on top of you, I think that can provide a pretty significant financial help for a lot of parents out there as well.
Agreed.
Let's get back to our beer, buddy. You and I enjoyed a...
Now you pronounce it.
Cuvée de Jonquille.
Okay, there you go. That sounds better than what I did.
I'm going to assume that means flower or daffodil.
No daffodils were harmed in the making of this beer.
The derivative of... don't know. I took Latin, so I feel like there's some sort of crossover. Maybe not. But yeah, what were your thoughts on this French beer donated to the show by Alice?
So Alice, in her email, mentioned that this beer is French, yes, but it's brewed very close to the border with Belgium, so it has those kind of Belgian vibes going on.
I searched Alice in my email, and I couldn't find it.
No. Maybe she just emailed me.
Fill me in with the details.
But it was so this very much tastes like a farmhouse beer. It's totally got those
Belgian vibes.
If there's a U.S. brewery that this has vibes of, it's Jester King, making some of those delicious, delicious farmhouse beers. And so this one is like a perfect table beer. It would go with like any meal. It's very yeast forward. It's got nice earthy notes and tones.
Yeah, totally.
I love it.
It's soft and delicate, but I totally agree. Like, it's got these herbal notes, and it's kind of weird because I know it's got pictures of daffodils on it, but it almost has dandelion like flavors. Have you ever eaten dandelion?
I can think of the smell in my head right now.
So the smell, the flavor is only, it's that smell, but heightened.
Okay.
I say that because as a kid, I think I remember eating a yellow dandelion.
Is that where the brain damage came from?
No, but you can actually eat dandelions. People put them in salads and stuff like that as well. Not something most people are doing, but it does have like this herbally, almost like dry vermouth, like tones and notes that you can typically find in like a dry martini. I'm almost picking up on those kind of notes within this beer, within the context of a Belgian farmhouse.
Yeah.
But
super good beer.
Farmhouse Saison style beer. Super good. Yeah.
Really fun and unique.
Not filtered. I can read that. Non-filtré.
Nice translation.
I think that's what that means right there.
Thank you so much, Alice, for sending this beer away.
Super we fun.
Are delighted to get to try a wonderful beer from the south of France. Matt, that's going to do it for
north
this
of France.
Belgium. North of France. That's right.
Yeah, that borders.
That's what I meant.
Okay.
I'm really bad in my geography, too.
South France is the coast.
That's true. All right, so that's going to do it for this episode. We'll have links to some of the resources we mentioned up on the show notes at howtomoney.com. Matt, until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out. Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox